papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
Welcome to the Media Project, a half hour of commentary and analysis, a conversation about the effort to find truth and report it to folks. That's the way we like to think about it. I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate America and formerly editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick. Ira, formerly the publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman and affiliated publications, what do you want to talk about today? Give me a brief...
Well, if I'm going to hold my publisher's card, I need to talk about something that is in financial area, and that is the notion of should news subscriptions be subsidized, which is something that is an odd thing to think about given what recently happened in public radio, but interesting theory about what we could do to increase digital readership.
All right, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratoga and the Record of Troy, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to talk about how the school shooting at the church is being covered.
Right. Covering those tragedies is always a big deal. This one has some particular nuances.
And Rex, if we have time toward the end or maybe another show, there was a study that showed that most Americans can't name their First Amendment rights. Mm. And we're trying to protect those rights. It would be helpful if people knew what they were.
That would be a good thing. And Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, what's on your mind?
Hey, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has announced that it's going to suspend or stop printing its paper. It's not that it's not going to cover the news going forward, but by the end of the year, we will no longer see a print version of that newspaper, that august newspaper.
Yeah, big newspaper, been around for a long time, used to be huge, as a matter of fact, in print. That's the latest one to make that decision. Okay, well, we will get to all of those, I promise. I really want to start with something that is fundamentally local, but actually it has broad ramifications, and that is a trial going on as we speak up in Saratoga Springs about a city commissioner named Dylan Moran, who is on trial for, and this is unique, for not fulfilling freedom of information requests. Now, under the state FOIL law, you know, public officials have to respond. They have to come up with documents that are requested. And he apparently refused a claim that he didn't have anything from the city Republican chair in Saratoga Springs, a guy named Michael Brandy. What is unusual is that you just never go on trial for this, but the sheriff's office cited him with three summonses of unlawful prevention of public access to records. It's non-criminal. But anyway, it's a whole trial that's going on. And what interests me about this is the general fact of the value of the Freedom of Information Law. You know, the fact is there's now a new University of Florida study that underscores what we have long believed, which is there's a link between the declining health of the local news ecosystem and decreased government transparency. This study found that states with fewer newspapers per capita are more likely to ignore or deny public documents requests. And when you consider the fact that over the past 20 years, you know, America's lost a third of its local newspapers and 60% of its local newspaper journalists, the fact is there is less public access to information. And we know that when that happens, when there's less public access to information, what happens? Well, there are increased partisanship, lower voter participation, diminished civic engagement, and even higher taxes when there isn't as much local news coverage. So this business of, I don't know, maybe Barbara, if your newspaper, the Saratogian, were still as aggressively engaged as it was when in the healthier days of newspapering, maybe this kind of cover-up wouldn't be going on in Saratoga Springs.
I don't know if it wouldn't be going on, but hopefully we would be reporting on it diligently. I have to say that this current situation, I'm following it in the news and I am finding it rather confusing. Definitely, this is a super important issue on a local level and for all of us. on a broader level because the Freedom of Information Law exists so that public records are made public. And it's important that the people who we elect or hire to serve us are providing those records to us when they're within the law to show those records when they don't qualify for exemptions. So here you have one of the city council members who has been charged, but they're not criminal charges, and for not providing records, pretending that the records never existed. And we need to go after that. And I'm interested to see how this plays out. I'm confused because I would think that the person bringing the requests for the records, which in this case happened to be the city Republican chair, should then be following up with an Article 78 procedure and then suing the city to get those records. And usually that ends up with a settlement of some sort, some resolution. I'm not clear how this ended up as a trial.
Sometimes don't you think we're the only ones, journalists are the only ones that care about government transparency?
I was just going to say, my experience over the years was that we either didn't do a good enough job explaining to the public what this FOIL law is all about, but we certainly didn't do a good enough job when we as individual entities went to court to try to get information. I found that many of the people who are our readers or our constituents saw it as a media issue. They didn't see it as a public issue. And when you try to explain that the information that we're not getting, that's being shielded from us, is information that you, the citizen in this community, deserve to have and should be cheering us on and supporting us, many people just don't understand the whole concept.
Because people like authority and they think that authority needs to be respected and that we must be doing something wrong trying to dig up some dirt on somebody.
Hmm. But what do you do if you're a journalist and you get a door slammed in your face? Typically, as you said, you file what's called an Article 78. That is, you claim that the denial is arbitrary and capricious, and then a judge can find that is so and order the documents released. But that can take months, years. And oftentimes you file a FOIL request and you'll be sitting there waiting a year for it or more.
Right, where the records that you're requesting become moot,
yeah,
as far as the case that you're trying to report on.
One of the mystifying aspects of this case is the testimony deals a lot with why the person is asking for the FOIL. I used to tell reporters, you don't have to answer the question about why you want a certain piece of information. Tell them you want to wallpaper your office with the with the data. That's none of their business why you want it. If you're entitled to the information, you're entitled to the information.
And in a digital age, it should become a matter of course for municipalities of all sizes to be having their records online and that they should be easily available digitally. And
it should actually be an impulse. That is, everything ought to be proactively filed, right? Should be proactively available to people. And actually, what would be wonderful would be if there were real teeth in the law, the FOIL law. There have been various proposals of that over the years so that this wouldn't be such an anomaly to actually have a trial, so that public officials would be subject to some sort of judicial review more immediate than a long Article 78 proceeding if they withhold stuff.
And there are rules. So if you're making a request for certain types of records and they are way too broad, they are not the types of records that they are not records that have been kept by the municipality for, you know, better or for worse, there are justifiable reasons that your requests can be denied or you could be sent back to the drawing board to fine-tune it. So sometimes somebody might be just trying to harass a municipality and ask for extensive records, which would require the time of staff that they really don't have for really no great purpose except to harass them. But Judy's absolutely right. In the law, this applies to everybody listening, you're not required to say why you are requesting those records, nor should you. That makes perfect sense. You don't need a reason. And you might be a news entity trying to report on something. There have been times when there's one arm of government suing another arm of government because they can't get the records. It could be homeowners or business people trying to get records to help them get the information that they need for something that involves them.
Fact of the matter is, actually, the preponderance of FOIL requests are not filed by journalists. That's the surprising thing for us. I think we think of ourselves as being the ones who are actually doing this all the time. But businesses primarily make use of FOIL requests because they need to find out information about development plans that they're going to do or how to get access to information. Information ought to be readily available. And so on the one hand, it's unusual for us Congress to see this. You can question, is obviously this is partisan because you have the Republican city chair using the Republican sheriff's office to go after the Democratic city commissioner. And I think there's partisanship involved in the DA's office. But the fact of the matter is, this is something that we maybe would see more of, and you might have more adherence, notwithstanding the decline of the media as a force in a lot of communities, if we did have teeth in the law.
And another issue is that, you know, in the olden days, everything was on paper, and there would be drawers of files of paper, and then a lot of that became electronically stored paper. Now, in addition to that, there's text messages and emails, and I am going to venture a guess that many municipalities are not clear about what their responsibility is in terms of saving those messages.
Good point. Well, as we were saying, this might be more frequently a case if there hadn't been such a decline in the reach of the media, about which, Judy, you wanted to say something. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution no longer going to appear in print as of the end of this year.
You know, it's expensive to print a newspaper. You have to pay for the paper, you have to pay for the ink, and you have to pay for the distribution. And those are big costs. They have long been one of the major drivers of expenses for newspapers. And with the availability of digital, people are finding it's much easier to just post their content online. And you know what? Reporters love it, too, because they can write as long as they want, even though we still don't want them to do that.
Yeah, except that as staffs are cut, the demand on those same reporters are greater than ever. So I don't know how much they like it.
You know, we've seen over the last 10 years, some newspapers went to fewer days a week of publishing in print. But, you know, the wholesale discontinuance of print is still unusual enough, at least in my mind, that it needs to be noted. I admit I am not picking up print papers as much as I used to, but I still think it gives you an experience that you can't get online. The going from page to page, discovering stories that you might not discover as you're scrolling up and down your homepage.
The Syracuse paper stopped 7-day print early on, about 15 years ago, and I remember having a conversation with the publisher out there. You'll appreciate this, Ira, as a former publisher. He said, "We know we're leaving money on the table right now, but we have to get our readership adjusted to the digital message. We have to get them out there so that we can have a digital product that's really robust."
Yeah. I mean, the handwriting, as we all know, has been on the wall for longer than just today with the Atlantic paper. We can see this coming. There are more going to be coming. As Judy points out, the expense of printing the paper itself is the second biggest expense that a newspaper has besides people. So it's bound to happen. But you're right, Judy, the old fogies like us still get more out of reading the news. You didn't say old fogies, by the way, I did. But I read the New York Times online every day, but I still get subscribed to the print paper. It's still there's stuff that you can see that you may have missed online, but people like me are dying out.
We need to get over it.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
Well, you're right.
And on the one hand, Ira, I agree. I get the Times Union in print, the New York Times several times a week, the Saratogian on Sundays in print. So I do value a print product, but I know I got to get over it. And what you're seeing in print is old, and it can't be corrected. It can't be updated. It's just...
The pictures
and
don't
it's
move.
Expensive.
It's expensive. But the fact is, so few people pay for what they get digitally. You know, only 17% of Americans, according to a survey last year, paid anything for the news. They say, well, I get enough news for free. And I guess that's true if the news you care about is, you know, Travis and Taylor or Cracker Barrel.
News.
It's news. I don't mean to denigrate it entirely. But if you really want great local news, you have to pay for it, and most people don't. And so, Ira, this comes to your point. You wanted to talk about subsidizing news subscriptions.
Yeah, I mean, this is, talk about whistling in the dark.
High in the sky?
Yeah. 83% of the country doesn't have a media subscription, and 74%, or there's a 74% of the publications have paywalls.
Yeah.
And what they're discovering, does the genius to agree, that newspapers, even in digital form, are expensive. And news organizations, not just newspapers, anybody that's got a news product, and the paywall is necessary to pay the bills. But people are not reading the papers or getting the information, putting it at the business of the journalists aside. Your audience, your readers, are not reading because they can't afford, many cannot afford the coverage that the digital product offers. And what's also happening as a result of that is that of those who do pay, they tend to be higher income people, so that the coverage allegedly swings more to their interests than to the interests of lower income people who can't afford it and wouldn't read it anyway. At any rate, there is this discussion about whether news subscriptions should be subsidized. It's called a patient assistant program. Oh, I'm sorry. That patient assistant program is the model that newspapers are using, and that's for pharmaceuticals. If you can't afford your medicine, there are assistant programs. And the question is, would a readership assistance program where money would be donated to help people get news that they're not currently getting be worth it, because you'd get a more informed public?
I love this idea. I think it's akin to a voucher program for schools. Everyone gets a voucher and they can spend their voucher money on a local publication. Again, we'd have the problem of, you know, what would be eligible to spend your money on, but I think that problem can be overcome. That way, maybe you could get a charitable foundation to pony up $10,000 or $20,000 to pay for that number of subscriptions for a certain segment of the population. I see no problems with it, even if you did a voucher for local businesses to advertise in their local newspaper. Again, I think it's one remedy. The problem, when you run into too many paywalls, you get discouraged with the whole news media business. I know, because I visit a lot of newspapers and I run into a lot of paywalls during the day.
I want to see more people subscribing to newspapers, but I don't like this idea at all. I think it's unrealistic. The place that we ought to be looking are the news companies that are producing the news, and they need to offer their products at a price that people can afford and that people will find a value in. So I think it's a lot of baloney that most people say they can't afford the newspaper. They don't find value in it. And I find that it's all very frustrating. I think people need to support newspapers. People who can afford to do it aren't doing it. But when you start to look at the variety of the offerings, that the price offerings are crazy. It was that way for, I remember when we both worked for the same company, and they would have these wild, and they probably still do have these wild ranging fees for subscriptions. They make no sense. If you know enough to complain about it, then you might get a better rate. If you're just accepting the amount, you're paying a crazy high amount. It's just disgusting that they scare people away. Or you can get, you know, the New York Times for a year, you know, $1 a week.
What about the idea that came 20 years ago that if publishers had adopted the notion of micropayments, you know, we have the technology that it's possible to pay as you go, pay for the stories that you have, and everybody put up a micropayment log on their site. Why did that not take effect? I guess because publishers didn't invest in that technology.
I don't remember us being involved with that, but it seems to me off the top of my head that it's just too confusing. Not enough planning could be done on what your budget is going to be based on this questionable amount of revenue that you might get.
But you could end up paying more than you would have if you took them up on a subscription offer by doing that. I run into the same frustration as Judy, where I start something, I hit a paywall, and then it's not one of the things I pay for, and it's like, heck with it, I'm going to just switch to something else. But if I had to click on something and my credit card's in there and I was going to pay it quarter to finish the story or 50 cents to finish the story, I might be insuckerated into doing that.
If you're in the business now, you'd like actually people hitting paywalls, because if they hit the paywall more often, enough people will convert, it will become subscribers.
Or give up. Have studies shown that will happen?
It's the how much you get out of it. You get more out of people hitting the paywall than you lose by giving away your content, basically. So it's always a battle between building audience or building revenue. And, you know, those of us on the editorial side want audience, and the folks who are doing IRIS work these days say, no, we want the revenue.
Well, the advocacy column for this points out that democratic countries like Denmark and Norway already directly subsidize journalism. Our government has washed its hands of this responsibility out of thrift, the misguided political belief that media must be financially independent, or a disingenuous attempt to avoid accountability. Regardless, the bulk of the media industry currently operates behind paywalls, and we must give those who can't cross over a meaningful opportunity to join us.
All right. That's the view of Martin Skladany.
Right, of the Columbia Journalism Review.
And the CJR, right. He's a professor somewhere. Anyway, that's an idea. By the way, folks, if you have thoughts on any of these topics we're talking about, media@wamc.org, media@wamc.org is how you get to the media project. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. And we did say that we were going to talk about the terrible calamity in Minneapolis, where a murderer opened fire at children in church. A 23-year-old shot through window and killed, at this reading, two youngsters and injured many more. How do you cover something like this? It's just a tragedy.
And, we have enough practice.
Yeah, we do. It's a terrible thing. In this case, there was a particular nuance that makes it difficult, and that is that Robin Westman is a trans woman. And so depending on who is covering the story, the shooter is identified as she, he, or they. This makes it awkward, and in the right-wing media ecosystem, there's a lot of talk about this as being a trans issue as opposed to a shooting issue. Even bringing up the issue is hard in straightforward journalism, isn't it?
You know, as we talk about this, we're still fairly early into this event. But so far, I think the regular media has done a yeoman's job of being fair, sticking to the facts, trying to be empathetic, or in trying to put things in context. I think they have not exaggerated the trans aspect of the shooter's personality. I think they have tried to be a moderating influence. But again, these are so difficult to cover in a way that will resonate with the public. You see the drip, drip, drip of information when it first happens, and you get caught up in that, and then you tend to be gone by the time you get more information about what's happening. But I agree, this right-wing conspiracy attack on the transgender community is outrageous, and I think the media has to not ignore it, and I'm slowly seeing that happen, that they're not ignoring it.
Your assessment of how well or not well the media has done on this is based on what? In other words, if you're just judging this on what you've absorbed from cable, or you couldn't have seen enough print as we sit to really know how that's...
Because we're taping this the day after.
Right, so I listened all day to cable, and then last night I was reading the initial stories, and they tend to do things like they do little snippets as things get updated, and we've been reading the full stories, and, you know, and some of the writing is very good, too. I mean, that's a small point, but on a case like this, you can really show the value of wonderful writing, and wonderful writing can really bring this kind of tragedy home in a way that, you know, simple declarative sentences don't.
Yeah, well, the reason I ask is it seems to me more and more as the years go by that we, the public at large, judges how the media, as a general term, does based on the cable channels, that most people don't see a variety of newspapers or either in print or online. But their sense of how something is being covered is the 24/7 nature of cable.
Which is problematic because the leading news source in the United States right now for Americans is social media.
Yeah.
It's not cable, it's not broadcast, it's not newspaper, certainly, or radio. It is social media. And so that is a plethora of voices, including the wackos who are attributing this to the person's gender identity, which, you know, they didn't do in the Las Vegas shooting. They didn't say, oh, these crazy old white men, they're all shooting people. Maybe we should start doing that, you know, and just tracking how many, or maybe we should do it by political persuasion and just see how many killers are. I'm facetious, of course, but I'm just saying that for the people who are doing this primarily on social media, that's going to reach an awful lot of people, unfortunately.
Yes, those are all legitimate questions that you're asking, even though it's facetious. Do you focus on their gender ID? Do you focus on their religion, the color of their hair, their age? You know, there's so many different ways to identify people, and it's just disgusting. And I find it just so upsetting that they've made a target out of transgender people as a result of this. And it's coming out of the White House. So the Homeland Security Secretary has stated that this is a man claiming to be transgender.
Oh,
great. So Kash Patel, the FBI director, is referring to the person as male. So there is, you know, I guess in keeping with the non-existence of transgender people in the eyes of the current administration. It's disgusting.
And so we have to draw an end to the show. We're out of time. Folks, we hope that you get some more thoughts on this and share them with us, media@wamc.org. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us in the Media Project. Gratitude to our producer, Dave Gustina, for making this all happen. We hope to see you again next week. Hear you again next week on the Media Project.
Such interesting people. when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustino. Thanks for listening.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.